This week on Potlatch, the Ammonic Dancers and reports on Canadian land claims and from Senator Ted Stevens. Here now, from Nome, Alaska, the Ammonic Dancers. The next dance is about a man with a sled going for driftwood. The man is pushing his sled full of wood, and he recognized that he's getting to be an old man, and his neck starts bothering him, then his legs. He's really getting old, not like when he was young. This is done by, I believe, Tommy Moses and Willie Moore. Two men dancing, one sitting, one kneeling. Three women standing in back of them in their very colorful cuss-bucks. The man with the sled going for driftwood.
Thank you.
This has been a program of Eskimo Dances by the Imangut Dancers. The first of a two-part series. Be sure to listen for the announcement of the second of this series. Our thanks to the dancers of Imangut for this fine entertainment.
That was thanks to Father Jim Poole at radio station KNOM. Here is a report now on Canadian land claims from Sue Pittman.
Which comes first, land claims or the pipeline? In 1971, the United States settled Alaska Native land claims before the Trans-Alaska pipeline proceeded. In Canada, a similar question is now being vigorously debated. On November 18th and 19th in Anchorage, a group of Canadians offered their perspectives on the questions of land claims and resource development in the Canadian North. The event was a conference entitled Northern Change, the Canadian Experience and Implications for Alaska, sponsored by the Arctic Institute of North America and the Alaska Humanities Forum. The similarities to Alaska's experience in the past few years were vivid. When Prudhoe Bay oil was discovered, Alaska found itself with untapped energy sources, which the rest of the country wanted very badly. Natural gas in the Mackenzie Delta has put northern Canadians in much the same position in their own country. And like Alaskans, northern Canadians would like control of their land. In addition, there's an immense variety of opinion on what kind of control and when. The Canadian government, represented at the conference by Keith Penner, Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Indian and Northern Affairs, feels that development of the non-renewable resources in the North must occur. But he says that Canadian policy has evolved to a philosophy of balance between social, economic, and political issues. In Penner's view, economic and social development must be merged and not allowed to proceed on separate, parallel courses as they have in Canada's past. With regard to the relationship between Canadian land claim settlements and resource development, he says,
the Canadian government is committed to a process of negotiation of the land claims. And as I said earlier, we have funded Native organizations so they can do research in land occupancy studies and land use studies. So we think it's important that they have this background, and we're prepared and ready and committed to negotiate before any major development projects take place.
But not all parties agree. Canadian Arctic Gas proposes to carry Mackenzie Gas and that from Alaska's North Slope in a pipeline through both countries. James Harvey, Vice President of Operations, told the conference the Canadian land claims were outside the scope of his company's concerns. He says Canadian Arctic Gas is primarily concerned with supplying the energy that is in the national interest of Canada and complying with environmental guidelines set down by the Canadian government. In recent newspaper articles, however, the Associated Press has reported on Native groups who have opposed construction of a pipeline in northern Canada until land claims are settled. Figuring out which Canadian Natives are making what demands is no easy task for an outsider. There are many separate land claims positions in northern Canada, from the Indian people, from the Inuit or Eskimo, and from the Métis or people of mixed blood. Métis representatives at the conference talked about the need for jobs in the north, and their desire that agreements about pipeline development occur immediately after settlement. No group, such as AFN, speaks in Canada on behalf of a united land claims demand. The Inuit proposal offers the possibility of a separate Eskimo territory in Canada without provincial status and a white province in part of the northern region. Yukon Indians are seeking firm control of renewable resources, which, as one observer from Whitehorse pointed out, would include hydroelectric potential, which may be the only resource left 100 years from now. Prior to Alaska's land claim settlement, it was often pointed out that since natives here had never been defeated in war or signed treaties, their claim to land was very strong. In Canada, the Indians are under treaty and have a trust relationship with the Canadian government. The Canadian Eskimos and Métis have no such history, and yet all groups seem to have strong cases for settlement demands. Much of the growing demand for land claims appears to have risen out of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline inquiry chaired by Mr. Justice Thomas Berger. The Bergeron Inquiry has spent the last 2 years listening to Canadian people talk about the proposed Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. The inquiry was funded by the Canadian government to encourage public input. Native groups and others received grants to act as interveners, formulating and presenting the testimony of specific groups. One Canadian at the conference said this was unusual in Canada, where public hearings often consist of bureaucrats reading public statements to those attending. But opinion was divided on whether the Bergeron Inquiry is fulfilling its assigned task.
According to Sue Pittman, a resident of Inuvik in the Northwest Territory said the inquiry took too long, that it delays the normal legislative process, and that people talked too much about land claims rather than specifics of the pipeline. A consultant to the Committee on Original People's Entitlement, Peter Usher, said that hundreds of Native people who spoke about maintaining their culture and the control of their way of life were a significant sample of Native opinion, and that land claim settlements were essential before pipeline decisions. The Berger Report is expected soon after the first of this year, and the National Energy Board expected to report on to the Minister of Indian and Northern Affairs in May of this year with recommendations on the Mackenzie Pipeline. Whether to support and license the Mackenzie route and whether to promote immediate or delayed construction are complex questions, but the conference with Professor Joe Meeker of Athabasca University in Edmonton posed another question, one not addressed by government nor industry.
It's a question of whether oil and gas development is or is not a reasonable basis upon which to build a northern future. The whole history of oil's importance will run its course in decades, and oil's total chapter in the whole of human history will be less than one century. What are we getting? What is civilization getting for out of these few decades during which oil is prominent in our minds, and what are we giving up in exchange? Well, if possibly oil is not a good basis for the future of the North or the future of anywhere, what are the values that matter? Maybe the point is that both human and environmental values can't be separated the way we have tended to separate them in our discussions during this meeting, because the humans, after all, remain animals living in their environments. The integrity of the whole has to be assured to some extent and in some manner.
Sue Pittman says that changes in the North are inevitable for both Canadians and Alaskans, with much work to be done in making future decisions. This is a report on a conference on Northern Change, sponsored by the Arctic Institute of North America and the Alaska Humanities Forum.
John Wesley Hardin lost his role shooting dice in the Jim Saloon in El Paso one night back in 95. For a while he sat there and watched the game, brooding, mad. Then he drew a pistol and said, "Give me my money back." And the timid soul handling the cash for the house said, "Take it all, Mr. Hardin, it belongs to you." Hardin got arrested for it the next day, but nobody thought to ask him to return the money. He did get told not to play that way anymore.
I know a man whose plow handle hand is quicker than a light. Wes Hardin is his name, they say. He travels in the night, for he might have to kill or walk around the fight. And if you ever saw Wes Hardin draw, you know he can skin his gun. He won't say how many tried and died up against the top hand, up against the wrong man, 'cause Hardin wouldn't run. He rode in like a Texas wind, took the eastbound train, Going, going with Jane Bowen till the lawman caught up. So long, Janie, chin up, I'll be back again. Off he went to Huntsville prison, so long, Jane, he cried. 15 years she waited till her heart broke and she died, and she left that bad land to wait up in the sky. Free at last, the paying passed for all the wrong he did. First free air they let him breathe since he was a kid. So let him come and let him go, let him deal and bid. Near the border in El Paso, lawyer reads a sign. You won't find him there for business every day at 9-4. Business is real bad. One client's all he's had in quite a long, long time. Then Sheriff Selman's boy broke in to Wes's woman's place. Up she jumped and pistol whipped him, kicked him in the face, and John Selman demands revenge for this disgrace. You could see every night by candlelight in Hardin's favorite bar, she'd be hanging on his arm, and very late they'd leave there, headed for the Goose Hair, glad it wasn't far. Right through the swinging doors, John Selman came with a blazing gun. Wes Hardin, chug-a-lugging red-eye, got him in the back of the head. John Wesley Hardin fell dead. Hardin wouldn't run.
That was Johnny Cash. Now a series of reports from Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. First, Stevens' comments on the issues involved in the Indian Health Care Improvement Act and what will result from the passage of the act.
Senators Abaresk and Gravel and I held four hearings in Alaska, along with John Borbridge, on the problem of the definition of a tribe as it affects Alaska. We have in Alaska several entities in each geographical region, that could be considered and could apply for participation under the Indian Health Care Improvement Act as the legal governing body of the tribe under that act. Now, when we came back from that hearing, strangely enough, one of the first bills that was on the floor was this Indian Health Care Improvement Act, which contains some of the language that was complained about at the hearings we held in the state. I had amendments ready to offer to straighten this out, but because those amendments would have required a conference with the House, and because we're quite close to the end of this session, when we determined that this Indian Health Care Improvement Act will not be implemented until 1978, in other words, there's a period of time within which regulations have to be considered and promulgated, and other activities will take place before that law is implemented by funds being appropriated for fiscal 1978. As I said, having found that out, I raised the question on the floor of the Senate, and Senator Jackson of Washington, the chairman of the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, assured me that before the act becomes effective in 1978, he would have hearings and would assist us in taking action to assure that the views of the Alaska Natives are carried out with regard to the definition of tribes as it occurs in this Indian Health Care Improvement Act.
The Indian Health Care Improvement Act authorizes $1.6 billion over the next five-year period to ensure better health care for Native Americans. A portion of this authorization will go for the construction of new hospitals, health care centers, and clinics nationwide. Another portion is dedicated to improving water and sanitary waste disposal systems in existing and new Native and Indian homes and communities. One of the provisions of the bill is that Medicare and Medicaid payments will go directly to Indian health hospitals instead of the federal treasury. This bill sets up a special recruitment program for health care training of young Native and Indian Americans under a scholarship grant concept. It also provides for summer intern programs and continued education allowances for Indian health service professionals. This law will go into effect in the fiscal year 1978, which begins in October of 1977, and we expect that many of these new programs will be of substantial benefit to Alaska.
Next, Senator Stevens reports on new technology which may help find downed airplanes.
It's possible to use satellites to locate emergency locator transmission from the downed aircraft. I think this is going to make progress now, and I'm hopeful that we can have a demonstration program to test the feasibility of the system in Alaska. NASA, the Department of Defense, and Department of Transportation, in cooperation with the Interagency Committee on Search and Rescue, have been involved in developing an innovative approach, and I'm trying to encourage them to use it in Alaska. We've known these ELTs, which are required on all civilian aircraft, and they have some deficiencies, particularly at times the signals are too weak and difficult to pick up in the very difficult terrain of Alaska. I actually think that the time will come when we'll be able to use satellites to pick up emergency transmissions, not only from aircraft, but from individuals who may be lost or in difficulty somewhere throughout our state. And I believe that in Alaska, where the distances are so great, that the satellites may give us the ability to use search and rescue on a more immediate basis.
Next, Senator Stevens reports on the North Pacific International Fur Seal Agreement and how this agreement will affect Alaska.
This treaty now allows for Native subsistence needs. The agreement recommends that measures be taken to restrict or suspend the harvest of seals when the seal population on a particular island falls below the maximum sustainable productivity level. In case of such a reduction, the natives' subsistence needs could still be met. And Indian Eskimos and Aleuts who live on the islands where fur seals breed could take seals for subsistence purposes if these needs could not be met in any other way. I think it's of particular importance to the Pribilof Islands, where there's currently a moratorium on sealing. St. George must now bring its first seal meat from St. Paul. Under this, it's my understanding that St. George will be able to take subsistence seal catch. The treaty is between the United States and the Soviet Union and Canada and Japan, and will have to be adopted by all four countries before it goes into effect.
In Senator Stevens' final report, he tells how people in the bush can take Federal Communications Commission examinations without spending a lot of money on travel.
We've been through this fight before, and there's no reason why rural Alaskans should have to travel great distances to these test sites when the examinations for these amateur type radio licenses can be accomplished through the mail. Now, I've been in contact with the FCC Commissioner Richard Wiley, asking that the Commission examine into our unique circumstances again, and particularly take into account the great distances involved in Alaska. The Commission has replied, indicating that they will undertake an additional investigation of the Alaska amateur license procedure. Among the things they are investigating is the possibility of establishing additional examination points in outlying areas of Alaska, and also the possibility of creating a special limited amateur license available by mail and valid only in Alaska. Until this investigation completed, the recommendations are sent to us. We're informed that the FCC will extend special consideration, to residents of Alaska living in remote sites on a case-by-case basis. And we'll continue to follow this up. If any of the rural Alaska residents feel they're being discriminated against on the amateur type radio license application, they should contact me or one of my offices in Alaska.
Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.